Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Laura Pritchett is a Colorado-based author with a deep appreciation and understanding of the people and the landscape of the Rocky Mountain Front. Her novel, Stars Go Blue, was the winner of the 2015 High Plains Book Award. Her new novel, The Blue Hour, has just been released.
Carolyn Patterson is a fourth-generation Montanan, a frequent contributor to numerous journals and regional magazines. She was also the editor of Montana Women Writers, A Geography of the Heart. Her new collection of short stories, Ballet at Moose Lodge, was published in 2017.
Laura and Carolyn are two successful contemporary women writers with a passion for telling the fascinating stories of the people and places of the American West. Laura Pritchett is a Colorado-based author of five literary novels and one book of nonfiction. Her work is deeply rooted in the American West, and it often focuses on issues of ecology, conservation, climate change, and social justice. She's been awarded the Penn USA Award for Fiction, the High Plains Literary Award, the Milkweed National Fiction Prize, and the Willa Fiction Award, among several others. I am pleased to have Laura Pritchett in the studio with us today. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me.
We first met in 2015 when your book, Stars Go Blue, won our fiction prize. And I just want to refresh people's memory about that incredible, beautiful book.
Stars Go Blue was loosely based on my father. I mean, the book is about a man who has just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and he needs to confront his daughter's killer, who's just been let out of prison before time runs out. That part is not based on reality, but which is good. But I had taken care of my dad for about 14 years during his decline into Alzheimer's. And I was walking across the ranch. I grew up on a ranch in northern Colorado. He had been a cattle geneticist with a ranch on the side. And I was working on a novel, and it was told from a daughter's point of view. And the daughter had a dad with Alzheimer's, so a little bit autobiographical. But he reached in his pocket, and he was fiddling for something. And I said, "What are you looking for, Dad?" And he said, "Well, you know, a slice of tree." And he meant a piece of paper, but he couldn't find the word for paper.
Oh, wow.
And he invented poetry, right? A slice of tree.
Oh, that's so beautiful, a slice of tree.
And I swear a shiver of lightning shot down from the skies and down my spine. And I thought, no, this book needs to be narrated by someone like that. It needs to be narrated by him. Someone who has to keep finding language, and it's more beautiful, but it's frustrating. Who doesn't have full access to language, but creates, you know, roundabout ways of getting there. And so I chose to write Stars Go Blue from his point of view and his caregiver, Rennie's point of view.
I just think anybody that's dealing with parents, aging parents, it's such a lovely read.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's very forgiving and loving, despite the fact that it's about redemption and revenge.
It is. Yeah, it takes on some tough stuff, but I hope it's done with
tough.
Love.
Speaking of tough stuff, I took your book, Red Lightning, to me when I went to Java on vacation. I thought, like, oh, that would be a perfect book to read. Came out in 2015, and wow, it's a story of what we call a coyote. Mm-hmm. People that are transporting individuals across the U.S.-Mexico border. It also takes place during the big fires in Colorado. It was an intense story. And I wonder where that came from. What was the impetus for that story?
I was really interested in writing about trauma and recovery from trauma, and specifically disassociation. And I had read several books, but my favorite is The Bone People by Carrie Hume, which won the Booker Prize in the 80s. And it's a book that more than any other, I mean, I threw it across the room several times, which I don't normally do with books, but it's a very frustrating read. But what it does is show on the page what is happening in our minds all the time, which is several layers of thought and, you know, during trauma, disassociation from the body. And it showed it on the page by indentions and parenthetical asides and different fonts, and, you know, so it wasn't like the vivid and continuous dream that some novels put you into. It was more work in both subject matter and because of the style of writing. And I wanted to do something similar. I had a character in my mind from my very first novel, Skybridge. It's told from the point of view of a woman named Libby, and she's a nice, kind, coming-of-age book kind of book, but her sister is named Tess, and she's much more troubled. And Tess kept wanting her story told, and I didn't quite want to do it for many years. I'd say, no, you're too dark, you're too troubled. But she kept coming back and said, tell my story, tell my story. And I finally had a lot of sympathy for her, which helped me write the novel, because she was just so wounded. And I thought that'd be so interesting to get in the mind of a very wounded person and, you know, extrapolated from that, a very wounded culture, because for a long time I've been involved with, you know, social justice issues involving immigrants. And it's part of, you know, my volunteer life and my early life of activism. So kind of to show trauma both on a cultural national level and within a young girl.
It was so timely in terms of what's going on in terms of immigrants and illegal immigrants and the horror of what happens to families and children. So what was your involvement with that?
You know, I went to Oaxaca, Mexico when I was quite young, and I spent a summer digging latrines, and I met a little boy named Alejandro. It's always the personal story, you know, that mm-hmm. makes an issue matter to you. And he lived in a village with no running water and no electricity and no toilets until my group called Amigos de las Americas came in. I learned so much that summer. You know, I don't know how much I helped them, but Alejandro kept saying, I just want to get to America to go to university. My heart would sink when he said that because I wasn't sure it was going to happen. I mean, we'd like to believe it can happen, but come on. Like, he had no mm-hmm. he had no school that was regular. He had no books. He had no, his family lived in a dirt hut. So, I mean, that was the thing that opened my eyes, and I just got involved in several different ways.
What I guess I love about that book, and I think I like about all of your work, is you take very contemporary social issues but weave them together into a really good read. So you have a new book that really has just been released, The Blue Hour, and the background of that is interesting in that it's a small group of residents that live somewhat isolated on Blue Moon Mountain. And the stories, they're interrelated, but it isn't the same kind of narrative as your other books.
My model for this, for example, was Winesburg, Ohio. I think for each book in which actually the town is the main character, and the town can only be understood and seen if it's told from many points of view. You know, it did start out as a short story collection. I was just going to have it loosely linked. And the more I worked with it, and this manuscript has been 10 or 12 years in the making.
Oh, really?
Because I went back and forth and changed its concept and different people became main characters. It didn't evolve in a smooth way like some of my other novels, you know, start with one. They have one narrator and they go from point A to point B, you know, and that's a pretty, it's a nice fluid way of plotting out a novel. But this one jumps back and forth through time, and I just, in the end, I thought, I wanted to challenge myself, but more than that, I thought, actually, I consider this book a novel. It's because it builds, the way it's connected and the way the voices inform one another feels more like a novel than, say, a collection of short stories.
Some of my favorite characters are the least likable characters,
too. Oh, good.
Oh, I love the man that's going through this drug.
He's so horrible.
He's so horrible, but his voice is wonderful. Was that fun to write?
It was fun and creepy. He gave me this squeeby jeebies.
He is creepy.
But I was trying to I'm always interested, even in the people I dislike the most, trying to understand their psychology and actually treat it with some grace, mm-hmm. even if I think they're not graceful people. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you read a section of the book, and then I have a couple questions for you afterwards. You have a section you'd like to...
I'll read a couple paragraphs from a story, one of my favorite stories that I think speaks to that theme. It's a woman, and this is based on a true story, actually, but a woman climbs into a bear den
oh.
and snuggles with the snuggles with a tranquilized bear, but her life has kind of fallen apart in important ways, and she needs to do something about it. The others were busy, so he leaned forward and whispered to Wynne, "I was thinking about this on the snowshoe up here. Even married people in Paris, of all places. Well, you better believe they doubt and suffer. They don't know what it is they want, and they don't know how best to get there. Whether they've given their life enough thought, which requires time, or if they've made the right decisions, which requires courage. They know as well as we do, Wynne, that life keeps an account of both the decisions we don't make and those we do. Don't beat yourself up about this anymore. Look forward. Be here. Be with the bear." Wynne nodded to him and herself. "You can do this. You will do this," she told herself. And she broke his gaze and looked in at the den. She patted his gloved hand with her own and then inched towards the bear, then past the mama bear, first on hands and knees, made difficult because of her avalanche shovel in one hand, and then on stomach as the cavern got even smaller. It was hard to make out how the body of the yearling was positioned, given the lack of light and the amount of fur, but she felt around until she knew she was touching his head. She couldn't raise her head to get a full view. She was smashed on her stomach, but she let go of the shovel, caution be damned, and put her other arm out. In this way, she was touching the mama bear's hind leg with her right hand, the yearling's shoulder with her left hand, and she lay gently digging her fingers into fur. They did not smell as bad as she thought they would, not the rank odor she'd smelled when they were near dumpsters of wild urine and rot. This smelled of pine needles and cold and something pure. She closed her eyes so she could breathe it in, feel the oily coarse fur, and rested her face down, right on the duff, the pine needles jabbing her cheekbone. She heard Sergio say something to her, probably beckoning her out, but she ignored him. "This is the best moment you are ever going to have," she told herself. "Please remember it so you can use it. Please find a way to hang on." Behind her, the sky was starting its turn towards the evening hour, le bleu, and surrounding her was rock. In the past were the times she'd forgotten to knock louder. In front of her was the descent down the mountain, in which they'd have to ride their avalanche shovels like sleds in an effort to make it to the trucks before dark. Below her ran the waters of the world. Above her was the arc of sky. And she stayed this way, although she knew she wouldn't have much longer now, that sedation was never a full guarantee, and almost all creatures would eventually resist the pull of sleep and awaken.
When I read that, I was so concerned that that bear was going to come out of the tranquilizer and trap her in there. I don't know. It was suspenseful. So one last question. Certainly, the environment and the isolation play a big part in this story. Mm-hmm. You have a map at the beginning of the book about where people live and the sort of trail up the mountain. How do you think that kind of isolation makes the characters or develops the characters in the book?
Part of one of the many themes of the book is isolation and the ways we reach out and connect. And that's a pretty common theme, but I wanted to make these people particularly aware of it because they really depend on each other and need to depend on each other and should depend on each other and be vulnerable in the ways that you need to be in order to form a family of sorts, really. And there's, you know, the conspiracy theorist and the conservatives and the liberals and the, you know, like everybody on this town has a different take on life, and yet to function and to have a meaningful life, they just really have to bear into that isolation and then, you know, bear away from it into each other.
And they've all chosen to be there.
They have, right.
Which is interesting. Mm-hmm. So, well, our guest today has been Laura Pritchett. And her new book is The Blue Hour, which was released in 2017. I encourage you to check out. And Laura, what's your website? You have all of your books on your website.
It's laurapritchett.com.
That's easy to remember. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
Carolyn Patterson is the executive director of the Missoula Writing Collaborative. and she's been teaching for the Collaborative since 2009. She's also the author of Montana Women Writers, A Geography of the Heart, and two children's books on nature. She's published numerous short stories in the journal, including Alaska Quarterly Review, Outside, Southwest Review, and 17. And she was awarded several fellowships, including the Wallace Stegner Fellowship in Fiction. Today, her new story collection, Ballet at the Moose Lodge, has just been published by Drumalon Press in Helena. And I am delighted to have Carolyn Patterson, who I have known since high school.
And that was just a few years ago.
Just a while ago. I remember you as sort of a thespian. Remember when they used the word thespian for astronomy nerds?
I do. And actually, I really started out as a musician. I was a pretty serious classical pianist. That was my aspiration in high school, was to be a pianist, a performer. But I always wrote as a child. I wrote in high school. Really, my life changed when I walked into a poetry workshop as a sophomore in college, and the teacher was Richard Hugo.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought, this is exactly what I want to do. It's music, and it's music and meaning, and that's what he used to talk about. It was like two planets collided.
Oh, that's so wonderful. But so did you start as a poet rather than a short story writer?
So I did start as a poet and kind of did that classic Faulknerian, you know, movement from being a poet, and my poems kept getting longer and longer, and so I moved on to short stories and have actually moved on and written novels also. But I love short stories. I love the shape of short stories. I think it appeals to the musical side of me, because there's a shape of short stories that's much like a sonata in a lot of ways. There's a real, you know, there's rising action, and there's a sense of resolution, and lots of variation and things you can do, that it's very much like a musical form.
And some of these stories go back, when I was looking at the list, as early as 1996, is that right?
Yeah.
So this collection has been a long time in the works.
It has been, yeah. Yeah, you just hang around long enough and somebody will finally take pity on you and publish your book.
Do you go back and re-edit those pieces? I know that most of the stories in the book have been published in various journals, and I'm just wondering, if something's 20 years old, do you want to go back and edit it, or do you...
No, there were a few stories that weren't finished from that time, and I definitely edited the ones that weren't finished, but the ones that were published generally felt finished to me, and I'm not a reworker of things.
Well, it's also
maybe
like a
little things.
But it's like a piece of music too.
Yeah,
you write it, and that's what it is, and it sort of speaks to a certain place and time.
Yeah, and there are things that I go back and I read that I'd written a long time ago, and I still really like them. Then there's other things that I read that were written at a particular time that seem very foreign to me, and I probably wouldn't write now, but they were really important to me to write at the time.
Of course, knowing you, I am so curious about what parts of those stories are you and what parts of them are some of that you've observed. And most of these stories are really an exploration of what it's like growing up to be a woman in the American West. And the narrators differ from teenage unwed mothers to daughters, teachers, homemakers, a variety of people. And of course, as a reader, we always want to know, are these based on personal experiences or on observation or both?
I'd say both. A lot of stories, I came from a large family of mothers and grandmothers, and particularly aunts. I had so many aunts, and they were all storytellers in one way or another. And they also would come and visit I don't know how my mother did this, but they would come for months at a time. They would come up and sew and vacation and visit, and people told stories. And I think I spent a lot of time, because in the summers there wasn't a whole lot to do when I grew up. There weren't all these camps and so on.
And you grew up in Missoula.
And I grew up, yeah, I was fourth generation Missoulian. So I actually now live in the home that my great-grandfather built in Missoula. So, you know, people really came back to the family house. And so I spent a lot of time around my, you know, my mother would make tea and cookies, and everyone would gather and just tell stories or boss each other around about sewing projects or what was the best diet or what was the best education to get. And I think I spent a lot of time just listening to these women talk.
So that makes me wonder about the first two stories in your collection are about women that move out into the Alaska wilderness, where there's a lot of men and hardship, and one follows a man up there. So did you also have that sort of experience? Did you leave sort of the comforts of your home to experience the wild of the West?
I did, although it wasn't as directly, and my history doesn't parallel exactly those stories. What I do a lot in my fiction is I start from nonfiction, and then I begin to fictionalize. And often I fictionalize so successfully that it replaces my own memories of the past. I did go to Alaska, and I lived up in Alaska for 2 years, and then I returned to Alaska about 5 years later. So I did have experiences similar to some of those in the story. It was a really important time for me. It was actually after I graduated from college, and I graduated on the East Coast and went directly to this tiny little fishing town. And it was a really hard time for me. It was in the 1970s. Everybody was trying to do work in their hands. They were returning. It was kind of like now, you know, everyone wanted to live in a cabin and haul their own water and build boats from their hands. And it was exciting, too, because people were kind of dropping out like they were now. It was impossible to get a job. So everyone was like, I'm going to travel. I'm going to adventure. And that's what I did. But we were also really broke. The cool thing about it for me was that that's when I really discovered writing on my own, outside of school, outside of other writers. And it was an exciting time, but a real formative time. I've written a lot about that time.
That kind of leads me to my next question. Dee McNamer, a Montana author, said that Patterson's characters are embedded in the West physically and emotionally, but their struggles are not local. Nor is the experience of reading these lovely original exploration of their lives. So I guess the question is, what makes a hard luck tale, like The Time in Alaska, become a hard to put down story?
Well, I hope it's a hard to put down story.
They were terrific.
I think it's something I've been trying to do for a really long time. So if I've done it successfully, I feel very grateful. I think all great literature is regional, but you have to transcend the reading and the telling of that story. So you have to find what is the most human experience within that region while using the tools of the region to tell that story, whether it's talking about the details of that region or closely observing the language and the behavior of that region. And also, I feel very bound to tell the story of this region because it's what I know really well and what I love really well. And it's not always an easy story. It's not always a pretty story.
Your first book was a collection of Montana women writers, A Geography of the Heart. And I think, I don't know how many years ago, we had you come down to Billings and we had a reading at one of the hospitals here, and it was so powerful because there were women in the hospital and the nuns that were in the hospital and a variety of people, and then the stories of these individual women, it was just a powerful evening. Do you remember that?
I remember it really well. Absolutely. And I remember how ferocious people were about their stories. And I love that about that project because I feel really strongly that as a literature in the West, we're just at the beginning of hearing these stories, women's stories, and they haven't really been told yet. And to hear to hear those stories that night was amazing. And people were telling these stories and telling them to one another, which is what I thought was really remarkable. Mm-hmm. I just had that happen again in Livingston, because I asked for stories from the audience, and someone was telling a story about a woman who worked on a railroad car there that nobody in town had knew about. And there are remarkable stories out there.
Wonderful. The title story in your short story collection, Ballet at the Moose Lodge, is a lot of fun. I'm assuming you must have been a child dancer. Were you put through your...
and I did take ballet at the Moose Lodge.
So tell just the premise of that story.
Well, the premise of it was that the narrator in the story is working in her mother's dress shop, and she is, you know, helping her mother in the store, and she looks up, and there's this unusual woman in the store who's buying this oddball thing that nobody in town would ever buy. And, of course, this woman is the dance teacher. And the dance teacher, as it turns out, is Dutch and has an accent and has ended up in this small town. And really, she's a refugee from the war and survived the Hungerwinter, which is this horrible winter that when the Nazis tried to starve out the Dutch because they were offering homes for Jewish people. Of course, none of us knew that, you know, in this little dance class. We're all dorky little Western kids.
But the dance teacher felt like every ballet dance teacher I have ever seen or met.
So the dance teacher was very passionate, very serious, and very strict, and at the same time was conducting this whole ballet class in the middle of the Moose Lodge, where she, where the men, you know, who were the pipe fitters and the loggers and the, you know, the car mechanics came in to, and they would watch all these little ballerinas like we were little Martians who had just landed there, and then they go into the nearby bar and drink, and while we were, you know, doing our port-de-bras and pliés, we could hear them drinking and shouting from the nearby bar. It was a pretty great contrast.
A colorful time in Missoula, Montana.
Yeah.
So, Carolyn, do you have a little section that you would like to read, kind of give us a flavor of maybe your writing?
Maybe I'll read that, the beginning of that, actually. That sounds perfect. Ballet at the Moose Lodge. You could read a town, Deborah's mother told her, by watching the way women shopped the harvest sale. Some picked, some pawed, some plucked, but everyone moved faster as they neared the sales racks, linen dresses at 60% off, rayon blouses for $1.50. At the dramatic reductions table, women combed through the stacks of slacks and summer shorts, and as others arrived, they grew frenzied, shedding cast-offs like snakeskins. Take the professor's wife, for example, her mother said. Every season she bought a suit straight off the rack, full price. She was new money. The doctor's wife, old money, with her three-story colonial on Squaw Creek, she never paid full price for anything. She was, her mother said, constitutionally cheap. Wives of school teachers, gas station mechanics, and mill workers came for the once-in-a-lifetime outfits, graduation suits, mother of the bride dresses. Then there were the shoppers who defied categorization, the ones who brought the oddest things, like the polka-dotted swing coat that hadn't sold in two seasons because it was simply too high style for Bridger. Imagine wearing a coat like that when you're trying to start your car at 20 below, Deborah heard one woman say to the other. The very coat a woman was buttoning to the chin as she pivoted from side to side, steadying herself in the mirror. The woman was, of course, Miss Sophie. Miss Sophie wore the polka-dotted coat for the next two winters, sub-zero temperatures be damned. Deborah knew this because her mother enrolled her in the Sophie Blick School of Dance. Her mother said it would give Deborah something to do beside working at the store after school or moping around the house, but deep down, Deborah suspected her mother looked at it as a business investment, as a way to keep in touch with the doctors and lawyers' wives who didn't invite her to their bridge clubs or symphony guilds, who didn't welcome a divorcee into their ranks. Miss Sophie set down her purchase on the counter and smiled at Deborah. "How old are you?" she said. 12, Deborah said. So nice to help your mother, Miss Sophie said. As if I had a choice, Deborah thought, as she wrapped the coat in tissue paper and put it in a bag featuring the woman with a wasp waist, large hat, and the logo, Nora's for the smart set. This will look lovely with your complexion, her mother said as she punched the register keys, ching ka ching ka ching ka ching, and the cash register drawer popped open with its rows of currency orderly as teeth. Lay it on, mother, Deborah thought as she handed Miss Sophie the bag.
Carolyn Patterson's new book of short stories, Ballet at the Moose Lodge, has been published. It's 2017,
mm-hmm.
correct?
So, yeah.
And it's available online and hopefully in a lot of Montana bookstores.
Thank you so much.
Carolyn, thank you for being here.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.